This is the Porno Cultures Podcast, the show where we think about pornography rather than just react to it. Welcome to the Porno Cultures Podcast. I'm so happy that we can finally premiere our first female guest on the show today. And I'm very happy that it's Professor Rebecca Sullivan. For some reason, I've had bad luck with having female guests on. Believe me, I've invited them on, but there always seems to be some bizarre circumstance that prevents them from being on the show. Hopefully, I'll have better luck in the future. On this episode, Rebecca talks to us about her role as part of the steering committee of the Canadian Sexuality Studies Association Conference, and about her book titled Bonnie Cher Klein's Not a Love Story, which is a deep textual and cultural analysis of the infamous second wave anti-porn documentary from 1981. In many ways, Rebecca's book is a type of restorative piece, arguing that the film is much more than just an example of reactionary anti-porn agiprop, but is instead an essential platform that showcases the voices of sex workers. And Rebecca also reminds us of Bonnie Cher Klein's reputation as being a progressive radical feminist in Quebec before the making of Not a Love Story, and her important role in the creation of the National Film Board of Canada's Studio D, which focused on making films about women's issues. This is a bold argument to make for a documentary that has for decades been used as a shorthand example of the worst elements of the anti-porn faction of the second wave feminist movement of the 1970s and 80s. But I think she makes her case for it pretty well in this interview. Sullivan also talks about why this anti-porn feminist movement left her disenchanted with academic feminist writing, and how queer theory acted as an important bridge for her to start writing about sexuality during her career as an academic. This interview was so fun for me because it filled in so many historical gaps that I needed to be filled. While you don't need to have seen Not a Love Story before listening to this interview in order to get the points that we're talking about, I would also say that it couldn't hurt to watch it beforehand. There's a YouTube link in the show notes where you could watch the entire documentary for free, and if you're interested in the history of pornography, this is an essential text to familiarize yourself with. It's the most financially successful documentary in the history of the NFB, and arguably the most culturally impactful film that they've ever produced. And thanks to Rebecca's book, we can now appreciate the film in all of its complexities. She also has another book titled Pornography, Structure, Agency, and Performance, which was co-written by Alan McKee. Unfortunately, we don't get to talk about that book in this interview, so be sure to check that out when you get a chance. One of the best things about meeting all of these guests for this podcast is realizing just how big a heart they have. And Rebecca surely has one of the most generous hearts I've come across so far. So I'm in my hotel room in Toronto. I'm ready to have my microphone plugged in to talk with her. I plug it into the computer, and for the first time ever, the microphone doesn't work. The computer doesn't recognize the microphone, and I'm there, figuratively, with my dick in my hand, and I'm thinking to myself, how on earth am I going to record this interview? Rebecca's going to be here in 10 minutes. Rebecca comes into the room. I'm completely dejected. I'm upset that I've traveled all this way to have a microphone that doesn't work. She's asking me what's wrong. I tell her that the microphone isn't working, and without missing a beat, she just says, don't worry about it. That's no big deal. She takes out her computer, and we record it on GarageBand, right on her laptop there, and she just diffuse a situation that I would have panicked and just turned into a disaster, and she turned it into a really great podcast. So I really have to give a huge shout out to her and thank her so much for making this happen, because if it wasn't for her steady hand, I don't even know if we'd have an interview today. So I just really want to thank Rebecca for that. She saved the day and she saved the podcast. So without further ado, here is my interview with Rebecca Sullivan. So we're here with Rebecca Sullivan, who's the professor and coordinator of the Women's Studies Program at the University of Calgary. She's the author of two books that we're going to be talking about today, a monograph titled Bonnie Cher Klein's Not a Love Story, which was part of the Canadian cinema series edited by Bart Beatty and Will Straw from the University of Toronto Press in 2014, and Pornography, Structure, Agency, and Performance, which was written by her and Alan McKee, published by Polity Press in 2015. Today, we're coming
coming to you from another location. We're coming from you from one of the countless and, might I add, soulless soaring towers that litter the skyline of Toronto. And we're here in Toronto because of a thing called Congress, which is an annual gathering of humanities professors from across Canada and the world, who present at a multitude of smaller academic conferences that take place over this 10 or 14-day period. And Rebecca Sullivan is the chair of the steering committee for one of those conferences, the fifth edition of the Sexualities Studies Association of Canada Conference, which just concluded today. It's hard to imagine. It just seemed like it started 2 seconds ago. I know this is an extraordinarily busy time for you, so thank you for doing this.
It is my pleasure.
I guess since we just went through this conference experience together, and then this was actually my first conference, I'm really interested to hear you talk a little bit about how this conference came to be a part of Congress, what is its history, and specifically, what do you as the head of the conference committee see as the goal of this conference as far as its impact throughout the field of sexuality, gender, and porn studies?
Well, I'm fairly new to the association despite my elevated role, and it's a very young association. It was started largely by pre-tenure scholars who weren't finding the space in all of Canadian academia to have these critical contemporary conversations that relate in a broad way to issues of sexual subjectivity and sexual self-determination. So what I'm really impressed about with this association is, yes, I feel like there is a space to have these conversations about porn and sex work more broadly. There is a terrific corner in the association, very strong around trans and genderqueer studies, which may not fit a rigid definition of sexuality studies. We fought very hard to recognize in Canada that gender is not the same as sex, is not the same as sexuality. But I think that there is a really obvious fit for trans studies in this space. And their long, long history of trans rights and sex worker rights have been very much connected. And I think there's a growing urgency. We're returning to some of these porn panic and sex panic times that aren't just about a fear of explicit sexuality, but are also about a fear of queer identities and queer subjectivities overtaking the supremacy of heteronormativity and heteronormative governance of Canadian society. So I'm really excited to be a part of this association and so grateful and awed by the young scholars who made it happen.
Now, you've been going to FSAC, and FSAC is the Film Studies Association of Canada Conference, and I'm assuming women's studies and other parts of Congress. Did you feel like Congress wasn't addressing a lot of these issues before? Like, was there a kind of omission or a silence going on?
I think that there has been some space in the Film Studies Association of Canada and the Canadian Communications Association. I'm a past president of CCA, so I guess I felt at home there. And the Women and Gender Studies Recherche Féministe of Canada, WGSRF. But interestingly, I think there's been a strong space for queer pornography scholarship, thanks mostly to Tom Waugh and his students, including you, and I don't want to start mentioning others because I'll forget one,
so
and that
many,
would be,
so
yeah, that would be terrible. But, you know, so we've had this space for queer pornography scholarship, particularly in FSAC, but not so much a more critically self-reflexive conversation for feminist approaches to pornography and for feminist pornography. That a lot of the scholarship has been feminist anti-porn, queer pro-porn, blah, blah, blah.
And how long is the Women's Studies Conference?
Oh, it's been around for a good 30 years.
Oh,
it's been around.
So in that conference, you didn't talk about pornography or...
I've never presented in the Women's Studies Association. I'm not sure what that says. I think it says my attentions were elsewhere. But it also didn't say that I would look and say, oh, I'm missing a conversation I should be a part of and running towards it. Where in the last couple of years, I was very excited to find out that there was a Sexuality Studies Association begun. And that's the association to which I have started running. And I think that says something.
And where do you come down on the question of the idea that if a certain subgenre of academia is given its own space, than it's ghettoized. Like the Porn Studies Journal, and also I was talking to some of my fellow classmates and commerce goers, and they are already complaining that the sexuality studies is being ghettoized in the sense that we're in a separate building. And that last year, apparently I was not there, but in Ottawa, there was a sexuality studies conference that was in like the basement of a building that was across campus. So are you concerned about this ghettoization?
Yeah, absolutely. We're always concerned about this problem. And I think it speaks more to Congress administration, which will actually probably be super boring to your listeners. But
we're going to get into Canadian politics.
Yeah.
If you can't handle that, you don't need to listen.
Yeah. So Congress is this bizarre entity that if you're not Canadian, you do not understand. It's anywhere from 7 to 9 thousand different academics from approximately 80 different associations. And it's hosted at a university campus. And you can only imagine the space politics of trying to fit everybody in. So this year, I wasn't too happy to find out that we were placed over in the Rogers Building with women's studies. And last year at Calgary, I was the local area coordinator for both those associations. And we don't have a spread out campus really at Calgary. And I was able to kind of negotiate at least a centralized location. I was told, if you're willing to take some not super great rooms, we can put you central. If you're going to get huffy about wanting windows and comfortable seating, you know.
Who needs windows?
Well, and let's be honest, right? I've worked at the University of Calgary for 17 years. I said, every classroom has its problems. So yes, I would rather be in the thick of it, in the center of it. I think the other issue for sexuality studies, which I have been pushing, is for us to branch out, to align with other associations. So for example, this year we connected with the Film Studies Association of Canada so that we could have, you know, a really important conversation about sexual politics and sexual media. And of course, my own work tells us that where sexual politics has been waged is not only on the street, but on the screen. And so bringing in John Grayson and celebrating Tom Waugh is a reminder that there's more going on here than film studies. To understand John Grayson's work without understanding it through sexuality studies and through porn studies and what porn studies has brought to cinema studies is incomplete, is inadequate. So that's going to be a real push for us in the association, is while we will maintain our ties with the Women's Studies Association, you know, recognize that historical linkage, we also need to recognize that there are scholars who aren't saying ghettoized. What they're saying is, thank God I found a home. My disciplinary silo schedules me last day, last session, you know, in the basement. No one but me is trying to do this work under this discipline. And I'm not mentioning a specific discipline for reasons, because it could be any of them.
Yeah.
So sexuality studies is always kind of ghettoized in these disciplines as an interdisciplinary space. So the idea that you have Sexuality Studies Association to come in and not have half the audience look at you like a zoo animal, some like, you know, what is this thing? What are you talking about? And the other half just kind of nervous and waiting for you to be done is such a relief to so many scholars. So what's interesting that I noticed is we're getting more full-time and post-tenure professors who've been kind of slogging it out in their discipline for so long, starting to notice that there is this thing called sexuality studies and that we are welcoming and that we are inclusive and that we are looking to have the contemporary conversation. So very much my journey has been a lot of other people's journeys.
Yeah, and I think for any academic that's listening, I mean, we've all been to conferences, and as a participant, we never know the politics of what's happening. Why are we stuck in this hotel? Why are we eating this food? Why are we here? So to get an inside look is very interesting from a person that never has organized a conference.
Yeah, so just a little quickie also on Congress is, of course, the larger associations dominate, and they get pride of place when it comes to rooms. And because we are one of the newer and smaller associations, it is what it is at this point. But the more that we are good Congress citizens, if you will, the better we are positioned. And with that, I'll also give a huge plug for going to the University of Regina, because the regional conferences are the good ones.
Mm, yeah, I went to Waterloo and it was much different than this. So you feel the sense of community. You can't go anywhere else. And so you're just really a family.
Yeah, you really do build the networks and build the lasting relationships. I'm kind of usually the opposite. I don't usually go to the big city ones. Mm-hmm. I wait for the Regina conference.
I'm probably the only one that was happy that the conference was where it was, because I'm only one block away from here. So what are your thoughts about this year's conference? What trends do you see emerging, and what might you like to see in the future? What things really struck you as like consistent themes and you're excited about?
What was really interesting to us was how much more work we were getting in what I'll call broadly cultural studies. So a lot more critical cultural theory, still very strong in some of the more sociological studies. We're building up another area. So there's been a lot of really great work, but it's been dealing predominantly with what I'll call everyday life and real subjects.
Not just numbers and data.
Yeah. And that's been great. But added to that, we're now dealing with representational and performance and, as I said, these critical cultural issues that give vibrancy to these questions of identity and subjectivity in everyday life, of being a sexual dissident. So I'm personally really intrigued by that. Really intrigued to see, again, just the number of people from other disciplines, people who have long been associated with one of the larger associations. There was one person in particular, again, I won't name the association, but I knew that they were stalwart in this one disciplinary association. And I said, so, hey, you know, this is great. What are you doing over in my neck of the woods? And they just said, I thought it was time to give my home discipline a little break and see if I can get a better conversation going somewhere else.
That's been my experience too, because I'm always in film studies conferences. So spending the time here was a unique experience for me. And I was hearing types of work and presentations that I typically don't see.
It's so refreshing to get in and be able to shorthand into your argument instead of having to lay it all out step by step, explaining specific language. I could just get to the point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely see that. Since we're in Canada, I wanted to get your opinion about what do you think about the divide in English language sexuality and porn studies? Now, I break it down this way, and you can be free to disagree with me. So we have the British model, which I see being exemplified by the editorial board of the Porn Studies Journal, which approaches the subdiscipline very much through a sociological approach. Like, there isn't a traditional type of sexuality or even, you know, film studies departments. There's like, they have to, and also I have French friends that they have to justify their work through numbers and interview and sociology. So we have the English model. Then we have, I would say, the American approach, which is through, I would still say, the Birmingham School, cultural studies perspective, using the Brits, Raymond Williams, but, you know, also, you know, stretching out with Linda Williams and what she did to take Marxism and everything. So we have, you know, statistical cultural studies. What do you think is the Canadian approach? What is uniquely Canadian about the way scholars here approach sexuality and porn studies?
Policy.
Interesting.
So I think what you're saying is kind of interesting, and I would agree with a bit of context here. First off, full disclosure, I'm also on the board of the journal Porn Studies, and I think what you're saying is really interesting, particularly since Clarissa Smith and Fiona Atwood are both far more aligned with media and cultural studies than they are with sociology. But what has been interesting is the need of that journal, or, you know, its natural inclination, has been publishing much more sociologically derived work, much more methodologically quantitative or mixed. And I wonder to what extent that has to do with what I see as a broad-based methodological turn in critical cultural studies. Film is probably one of the last holdouts, sticking to various forms of close reading, formal analysis or ideological analysis, but still, this is a film, this is my theory. Two great tastes that go great together. But I'm actually on a panel tomorrow about this methodological turn and trying to get some evidence in. And I think that has to do with political issues in porn studies, of we're seeing this return of anti-porn is actually gaining traction. We kind of took our foot off the gas and we're losing ground. And it's so frustrating. It's like fighting with a toddler sometimes. It's like, no, it isn't. Yes, it is. No, it isn't. You know, so we're rushing to the data. And as much as I am a bit of a data fetishist, I'm also realizing with great frustration that not simply in sexual politics, but across the board, evidence is seen as an ideological enemy. We can't win on evidence.
Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton thing, yes, that the progressives or liberals, they were bringing facts to a knife fight.
Yes.
And that we kept on talking about fake news, fake facts, alternative facts, but facts don't speak to passion.
Exactly. And so, I mean, we're getting a bit off topic, but there was this fascinating article that I read in The Guardian. It reframed the facts emotion argument around traditional statistics versus big data. And we are not trained in big data. So what's happening isn't so much facts against emotion, which is actually an easier fight. What's happening is statistical facts versus big data truthy
things. Algorithms.
Yeah, big data algorithms.
Algorithms could be whatever you want.
So what they're doing is they're gathering facts about their audience in order to direct deliver. It's almost like we're going back to the sender message receiver model. It's like finally, you know, it only took 50 years, but Norbert Wiener was finally right. And injecting them with facts, I'm making scare quotes, that they want to believe based on the facts that they have about this person, this group's mentality. We have the facts that they'll believe this, and so we'll deliver it to them. We're going to lose on that in sexual politics because we get bogged down in these moral panics and people genuinely believe them as facts. It's incredibly frustrating. So I think that that has happened in within the Journal of Porn Studies. And then, of course, as you mentioned, so much of porn studies came out of cinema studies, and in particular the Society for Cinema and Media Studies. Linda Williams hosted the first academic panel on pornography at what was then the Society for Cinema Studies back in the 1980s. I can't remember the exact date.
Early mid?
I'm going to say 84.
Oh, wow.
But okay. Don't quote, no, like, well, yeah, you want, you are, will quote me, but don't quote me as saying I know that's true.
Were you there?
I was still in my undergrad days. Actually, I was still, I graduated from high school in 84. So that there, you can all do the post-dating. I'm sure Tom was there. So a lot of porn studies did come out of film studies in North America. So now, why did I say policy? Here's why I said policy. Canadian media studies and Canadian cinema and media studies, but particularly media studies, has always been, as historically been, I should say, heavily invested in issues of policy, and within that, issues of technology. Because issues of policy are issues of distribution, transmission, and issues of governance, if you will. And porn has been a subject of governance, to use Foucault's term, you know, this governmentality model, where what do we do in Canada if we're having a public debate? We strike a commission, we strike a committee. And we research it and we make no decisions and then we wander away until it flares up again.
Because I would say while Canada only actually has half the population of England, they're modeled after each other. But your government is smaller, so they act really quickly. Like the American government is so diffused and big in 50 states, our government doesn't act very quickly. So it's interesting that you mentioned that. It seems like the Canadian government can act faster to a lot of different things. Well, you did the gay marriage first, you did the pot legalization.
What the Canadian government does is adhere to the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and therefore we abdicate a political debate in favor of a juridical debate. We toss complex social issues to the courts. It's a form of political cowardice, but it's also a form of political administration. It's one that I will call cowardice on one level, but I'll also say it helps us to avoid some of the more contentious and fraught debates that aren't based on a sober reading of rights and freedoms. It's based on, you know, political point scoring. Because in Canada we have consent is enshrined in our legislation and our criminal codes around sexuality, and harm is enshrined, but neither are practiced, not particularly well. So when we get into these questions of pornography, where does it end up? It ends up at the House of Commons Standing Committee on Health. That's where we end up having these conversations. So it ends up locked into the governance structure. And that's like this safety valve area to have pretty much any conversation in Canada. In my mind, it is extremely problematic and very frightening, because what happens is the conversation begins to revolve around this idea of sexual citizenship and a very narrowly defined and deeply heteronormative definition of sexual citizenship, in which full sexual citizenship is really only granted to one subject, and that subject isn't even an individual. It's the family.
That's neoliberal order of the day, the family. And you mentioned in your presentation today, and it's true, rape, incest, abuse, all of that happens mostly within the family. It's not a stranger who abuses you or a stranger who rapes you. It's someone that you know.
And it's not a porn film that does it
no,
either.
No, it's reality.
And it's not your relative looking at porn that assaulted you and abused you and violated you. It's a family member. I just want to suggest here that, as we speak about these things, I hope that no one is feeling triggered and concerned, because we need to have these conversations about very real issues of sexual and gender and family violence. And what really concerns me about the most recent flare-up of the porn wars in Canada is that instead of having that conversation, we are having a conversation about porn as a public health crisis. And that is dangerous. That creates very real risk, because there's only so much time to have conversations. And if we're having a conversation about porn, then we are not having those conversations. And in fact, we're having that conversation about porn in order to not have conversation about gender violence, sexual violence, family violence, and queer and transphobia.
You make a good point. It struck me that the Porn Studies Journal went towards this little bit more of a quantitative statistical model because of what I've been hearing of all of the legislation that started under Cameron of really trying to restrict pornography. I think there was one university in New Zealand that bans all porn sites on campus.
Now, so why don't they ban intramural sports?
Oh,
you know,
or,
right?
You're right. Maybe I'm taking my foot off the pedal, but it seems as if it's happening much slower in America because of the diffused nature of the way our media is and the way the government is. In Canada, New Zealand, and England can move much faster to restrict.
Yeah, well, except that you're forgetting that the restrictions are happening at the state level. Mm-hmm. Right? So the whole porn as a public health crisis has gone to the state level. So I think there are now 7 states, could be more at this point, that have passed legislation against porn, citing this public health crisis. So yes, the fact that you don't have a strong federal government in the United States means that at the state level, some rather constitutionally dubious laws get passed pretty quickly.
It'll be a question whether it gets to the Supreme Court and what they have to say about it.
And it's a very different Supreme Court in the United States as
yeah.
well. One of the benefits of having a fairly recent constitution is we were able to learn from other mistakes. So far, I will say, in recent years, the Canadian Supreme Court has been ruling much more liberally around sex worker rights. So in 2013, we had the Supreme Court case around sex work, what we still call in the legislation prostitution laws. And the Supreme Court ruled that all laws restricting or criminalizing any aspect of sex work were unconstitutional because it infringed on the security of the sex worker. So we didn't go individual right. We went the security of the sex workers are paramount, and criminalization of sex work interferes with their right to security. And I agree, and I was thrilled. And I think that that's really important. The problem is the government can just ignore it. And in fact, they did. They returned with laws that were even more draconian.
It's a battle. And what we learned at Tom Waugh's retirement thing yesterday, the need to meld academia and activism. Because if you're not fighting the battle on the streets, you're losing the battle in the classroom.
Yeah, and I think that's very true. So Brandon was referring to, we had a retirement celebration for Tom Waugh with John Grayson, and these are two individuals who have never separated the street from the classroom. And how we meld that activism and education, and how, for me, it's always been about how much I need to learn from the activists. And one of the things that is very important in any kind of sex work research, porn, stripping, any kind, there is a separate and rigorous code of conduct, an ethics of nothing about us without us. So I may be adhering to academic ethics as laid out by my university, but that's not good enough. I have to adhere to the ethics of sex worker activism, and I take that very seriously.
Well, speaking of Canada, consent, sex work, this brings us to your very interesting book, which is a thorough analysis of the 1981 documentary Not a Love Story, a film about pornography. It was produced by the National Film Board of Canada, and it became one of their most commercially successful documentaries. It had emerged out of a very politically progressive moment in the board's history, where they had just created an internal division called the Women's Unit, Studio D, which was tasked with creating documentaries focusing on women's rights and issues. And the unit was directed by one of their resident filmmakers, Bonnie Cher Klein. For those who have never seen the film, and you should check it out on YouTube, you can watch it there for free, Not a Love Story is considered the primary visual document of second wave feminist anti-pornography movement. In it, pornography is compared to, and blamed for in some instances, rape, physical abuse, and murder. Now, before I moved to Canada, I had never heard of this movie, and I was teaching assistant for Tom Waugh's sexual representation and cinema course. So I think at around the second or third class, we watch an hour of this movie. And it's about an hour and 20 minutes?
I will say, because it's a bit of a funny thing, the movie is 69 minutes, which both the director and the producer, when they realized it was there, thought that was so funny, and I kind of think it's funny. So it's a bit of an inside joke between the two of them.
Yeah, so we watch maybe about 50 minutes. And you know Tom's feelings about the film, and we'll go into that. But it's very much set up as examples to show the students what second wave feminism looked like and have an easy bite-sized example so we can talk about it, say how horrible it is, and move on with our lives. And we can all walk out of the room saying, well, thank God we're not like that. So that was my impression of the film. And then I taught the class twice, and I did the same thing. You know, you throw the ball up for the kids, and they hit it, and it's great, and we'll all leave the class happy. However, despite the end result of the moralizing that goes on throughout much of the film, you make a very interesting case for other elements of the documentary and attempt to salvage parts of it as actually, quote, giving voice to the women and men who work in the sex industry without expecting them to recant or testify to their own exploitation, unquote. And you argue that the voices allowed to speak and the structure of the filmmaking process itself are elements that should be reevaluated. However, before we get into all of that, I think some background about how this film came to be would help listeners understand where you're coming from. So, one, tell us a quick synopsis of the film. And why don't you tell us about the environment in Canada at the time that facilitated the creation of the NFB Women's Unit? And then tell us about the very politicized and progressive background of Bonnie Cher Klein, which, who's anyone who's ever seen the film, would never think of her as a progressive.
Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, Bonnie has fought quite the good fight. Okay, so for those of you who aren't familiar, in the 60s, the National Film Board of Canada took this kind of amazing swing to a left liberal progressivism and began experimenting with political agitprop cinema and community participatory documentary. So Canada is known for its documentary. So there was this wonderful experiment in participatory documentary called Challenge for Change. Bonnie Klein was a member of the Challenge for Change. She and her husband, Michael Klein, Michael was fleeing the Vietnam War draft, so they moved to Canada, and Bonnie was an aspiring filmmaker, so they moved to Montreal so she could see if she could get any work at the NFB. You know, it was a different time. They're like, hey, sure, come on. And so she began working for Challenge for Change, as did another filmmaker, Kathleen Shannon. Okay, so flash forward, 1975 was the year of the woman. So NFB's got to do something about that. So they're kind of gearing up. And so they asked Kathleen Shannon if she would head up a new women's unit, which was not supposed to reflect women's issues, was just supposed to hire and mentor women. But Kathleen Shannon was a committed feminist, very classically second wave feminist, but she said, not only will this women's unit be women in the unit, but we are responsible to a global sisterhood. So we are responding to an international movement. This did not make the NFB powers happy at all. And when Studio D was created, Bonnie was asked to come back. They'd moved back to the States because the war had ended, but the chance to come back they took, and they've been in Canada ever since. So around 1979 or so, the porn wars start to flare up in Canada, and they're deeply informed by what's going on in the United States. But what we have in Canada at that time is the provinces are responsible for film classification. And Ontario in particular, its film classification board was run by a woman named Mary Brown, who is still notoriously known. Like, mention the name Mary Brown to people of a certain generation and watch the twitching occur. So we had incredibly high levels of film censorship going on in the most populous provinces and the center of film production. And so censorship was a huge issue within the film community. So the anti-porn movement was very much listening to Robin Morgan and Andrea Dworkin and doing what they told them to do. And then I can't even call it, I would just call it the anti-anti-porn movement, was an anti-censorship movement. So the thing about Studio D was they decided that they wanted to be speaking with and for the everyday woman. So they weren't really interested in engaging with the film community per se. And in fact, there's a quote in the book where Bonnie says, wasn't until around the time of making Not a Love Story that she was finally comfortable with calling herself an artist. She always felt that she was an educator and that documentary film was an educational tool, not an artistic practice. So what's really interesting about this film is that it is the very first full-length documentary on pornography and a feminist film to boot. The other interesting thing about the film is that it was initially conceived of as a celebration of women's sexuality, an opportunity for women to talk about sexual pleasure and what is sexual pleasure. But of course, in the 1980s, porn was becoming much more visible. And this is where I kind of diverge from Tom, coming from it from a queer's perspective. I'm going, and let's be honest, if we want to talk about porn for straight people, it was awful. And even like the early versions of feminist porn, like Candida Royale, apparently what women like out of sex is a lot of scarves and a lot of gold filters. Tedious, tedious stuff. So there needed to be a conversation. There was very little out there for women sexual pleasure, right?
Porn and made for women by women, you mean?
Yeah, but even the porn made by women for women was just
not great, yeah.
Yeah, kind of gaggy and not in a good way, you know? Yeah, not fun gaggy. So what I try to say in this book is say, despite all the problems, and there are major problems with this film, what it was also trying to speak to was a moment where we didn't have any language or any examples of pleasure, positive, and feminist positive sexual expression. It was happening in queer places, lots for men and some for women. And I'm being very gender binary here because it was the early 80s. So it did exist. And of course, we had Gail Rubin and Carol Vance fighting for pornography, but it was very much through a queer, well, before queer had been termed, queer, lesbian, kink environment. But within heteronormative relationships, within heterosexual relationships, at a time when feminism was still dealing with some pretty, you know, hideous issues of violence and rape, just being able to articulate that, there was nothing in heterosexual porn, really, I mean, maybe pockets, but not really, that was pleasure positive, sex positive. And there was no language to talk about this other than anti-porn or anti-censorship. Now, here's the key thing about this film. It was criticized for being pro-censorship. It was not. There is no case to be made that the film is pro-censorship unless you were living in Toronto and fighting against Mary Brown. But Bonnie Klein was not living in Toronto. She was living in Montreal and was shocked when she was accused of being pro-censorship, because what's interesting is Mary Brown censored Not a Love Story. So what my argument ultimately is about this film, it's like it's this weird journey into porno land. A nice middle class married mom goes to seedy New York City and is shocked by what she sees. The headlines write themselves. And it also documents the journey of a partner, a stripper by the name of Linda Lee Tracy, who goes down with her as her guide. And the film suggests that Linda Lee Tracy repents of her stripper ways. That was not true. It was never true. And Linda Lee Tracy felt great harm at the way in which the film was taken up and people seeing her as repentant. But there are these moments in the film where Bonnie is sincerely trying to talk to performers and ask them about their work. And I'll tell a quick story. If you see the film, there's this one woman, Patrice, who does live sex shows at Showworld in Times Square, the notorious porn palace. And we were watching the film together. And we were finished the segment on Patrice. And Bonnie turned to me and said, "So what was wrong with that?" And I said, "You know what? Nothing." Patrice is speaking honestly and candidly. She is looking into the camera. You are being respectful. She's talking about what she loves about her work. She's talking about what she doesn't like, which is the lack of respect and dignity that the audience gives her. But she's talking positively about self-determination and owning her sexuality and talking about how exploited she felt when she worked in an office. And I was like, yeah, you know what? We have to pay attention to those moments. Because if we don't hear what Patrice said, if we say that this film is exploitative and dismissive of sex workers' voices, then we as an audience are being exploitative and dismissive of those voices. Patrice is speaking for herself. We must give her dignity. She demands it.
Is this the scene where she's interviewing her through the glass and then the door keeps coming down?
No, because, that is...
I mean, I will just say for those who don't know, there is one interview where she goes to a porn showcase and after you put the quarter in and the time has run out, the door closes and you have to put the quarter into... And I always have a little bit of a problem with that scene because it gives the idea that there is no editing involved, which of course all documents are highly edited. And when you choose not to edit something like that out, it shrinks the woman down into like, she's only worth this quarter at that moment. And I always have a very uncomfortable feeling about that scene.
So that is a different scene. That is a scene with Blue Sky. The reason why they shot it that way is because Bonnie did not want to take her from her work and wanted to make sure she got paid.
Yeah, that's one point you make. Yeah. But that everyone who talks is paid.
No, well, so they were paid a small honorarium, mm-hmm. but also Blue Sky did not want to go to their home or anything. The only place to talk was at work and she was working. So this was the only place to do it. So it's like, well, you know, let me go get the tokens and you can get paid while working. And so I agree with you on one level, but I will also challenge you to think, but that is her job and that is how she is getting paid and Bonnie is paying her. And if that makes you uncomfortable, what does that say more about you in accepting the realities of survival-based sex work? She was not at the top of the heap in the club. This is what she did for a living. And the more I watch the film, the more I refuse to see it as degrading because Blue Sky refuses to see it as degrading. She talks about, well, this is what I don't like and this is what I do like. And she talks about it as you feel pride in your work if you can get them to put that quarter back in. So the slide going down and the slide going up is to Blue Sky a sign of victory, a sign of a job well done, a sign of pride in her performance.
That's an interesting perspective. Klein wasn't the only responsible for the direction of the film. Those listening might be surprised to find out that the film was actually a collaboration with a Toronto stripper/performer, Linda Lee Tracy. They both agreed that, quote, Tracy had the right to say and do what she did and didn't want in the film, including edit. Could you talk a bit about how Klein found Tracy and explain what were the intentions of the film before they started shooting?
So Linda Lee Tracy died in 2005, so I was not able to interview her. She's a fascinating figure who became an important documentary filmmaker in her own right, and there is the annual Linda Lee Tracy Prize for a new documentary filmmaker. And it was important to me to honor her memory and honor the story that she left. So she wrote a memoir, Growing Up Naked, My Life in the Bump and Grind, where she talks about her experience. And then I also interviewed Bonnie, talked about her experience. So Linda Lee Tracy was a stripper in Montreal and also a performance artist and poet, you know, a really interesting figure way ahead of their time in terms of sex worker rights, and spoke very candidly about she uses stripping to pay for her ability to do art. 1 week of stripping is 2 months' living expenses. The problem occurred more so in the editing room.
Well, just quickly, how did Klein find her?
So Klein found her because a mutual friend said, well, if you're going to do this film, you should really get to know Linda Lee Tracy, who at that point was running fundraisers for the children's hospital called Tits for Toys.
That's in the film.
Yeah. And speaking out about working conditions and other really important issues that we still weren't having these performer rights conversations. We were still bogged down in this anti-porn, anti-censorship. And we weren't talking about performance and labor and dignity and self-determination. That language simply didn't exist. Linda Lee Tracy was initiating it, but still, you know, very early terms. So Bonnie was so enchanted by Linda Lee Tracy that she asked her to participate in the film. So a contract was drawn up, expenses paid, honorarium paid. And this was not something that the NFB was used to. And this goes back to early documentary ethics, where if you paid your documentary subjects, then it was no longer authentic, this kind of vulgar Marxism, which we've gotten over. We recognize that documentary has its own performative narrative space and that subjects should be compensated for the time that they are giving to the documentary filmmaker. And that can occur in various ways. But you can imagine how aghast the NFB was. Any documentary filmmaker would have been aghast in 1980 to pay their documentary subjects.
You talk about the rate of inflation, she was paid very well.
Speaking of data, I poured through the actuarial tables because I was like, I don't know what this money means.
Yeah.
And so, yes, in my estimation, it was a fair contract and with numerous updates as the film blew up to be this incredible commercial and critical success, touring the world. And Linda Lee Tracy was in demand and for the most part was paid. There were huge problems getting the NFB to cut the check, but well, I mean, there's still huge problems with getting any bureaucracy to cut a check. So Linda Lee Tracy features prominently in the film and there are some key sequences of her performance.
And if you do watch the first 20 minutes of it, you think, well, wow, this is really interesting, this woman. And you're like, wow, I'm seeing a different side of pornography. But then it does take a downturn. And one question I wanted to ask, now, many prominent anti-porn women and men are interviewed in the film, and they're interviewed in a very highly sympathetic fashion without much pushback at all.
Yes.
Where was Linda Lee Tracy when these interviews with the anti-porn feminists were being shot?
In the room with them.
About
the only one she wasn't, I think, is Kathleen Berry. She was in the room with Susan Griffin. She was in the room with Robin Morgan.
Is she in the scene where the woman starts crying and then her son has to go in?
That's Robin Morgan. Yep, she's there.
Linda Lee was there. And did she feel like she couldn't speak up against these people?
Well, you know, I don't want to speak for Tracy. I think that, you know, these are very educated, eloquent, and passionate women. This is Robin Morgan, one of the key leaders of the radical feminist movement. This is Susan Griffin, who is just gentle and delicate. Like, you can't help liking her even as you're going, I don't like what you're saying, oh my gosh. And this is Kate Millett, who was, again, another significant leader, was on the cover of Time magazine. So definitely Susan Griffin and Robin Morgan, Linda Lee Tracy is there. and definitely Suze Randall, who was the first woman photographer on staff at Playboy and then at Penthouse. So Linda Lee Tracy was there in a lot of these moments. But this is the struggle of documentary ethics. Being in the moment is one thing. Being in the editing suite is another.
So Linda Lee wasn't in the editing suite?
No, she was not. And interestingly enough, Bonnie kept close tie. One of the reasons why the editor is given an assistant director credit is because Bonnie actually had to leave the country for much of the time that the editing was taking place. I'm not trying to forgive Bonnie, I'm just saying this is a bit of an interesting tidbit. And therefore, Anne Henderson took on a lion's share of piecing it all together. That said, both Bonnie and the producer, Dorothy Aneau, really wanted that footage of the American feminists in place. And that was, I think, a key editorial decision that disappoints. I feel personally, with the mountain of footage that they had from sex workers doing anything from live sex shows to stripping. There's actually very few porn performers in the film. What a film it could have been if we had just cut all those American anti-porn feminists out.
Now, did you get to see any of the raw footage?
No, we don't have archives at the NFB in any meaningful way. It's a real tragedy.
Now, you've already spoken kind of this point already. What's most interesting about the book is the degree to which it reveals how the intentions with which we go into making a film often gets bogged down in the realities of what it means to make a film. A film, of course, is made three separate times, in its conception, in its execution, and in the editing room. That goes for any film. The Magnificent Ambersons, Orson Welles is out of the country for that edit, and look what happened with that. This is how something that was meant to illustrate the spectrum of female sexuality gets subsumed within the arguments of the time and turns into this anti-porn manifesto. And while the production history of any film is important to acknowledge, Shakespeare famously said, "The play's the thing." So theoretically, how deep can we go into any film's production history in order to exercise it for its sins? I mean, couldn't one argue that Leni Riefenstahl's Olympia is intended as a mere exercise to showcase the athleticism of the 1936 Olympians? How far are any of us to go in redeeming the intentions of a completed film? You've talked about the ethics of a documentarian. What are the ethics of an academic?
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you brought that up. So I think documentary becomes more fraught in this regard, more problematic because, well, yeah, you mentioned Magnificent Ambersons. The artist can, over the course of the production, lose control of the film. In documentary, the artist never really does have control of the film. For example, in Not a Love Story, a moment occurs in the shooting of a porn shoot for Hustler magazine, because Suze Randall by that point was working for Hustler, where one of the models breaks down and says they hate doing the work and they hate what Suze is doing to them. Suze is so upset about this that she flees the room. So everybody's in tears. And then she comes back and agrees to have an interview. So Suze Randall and Bonnie Klein agree to sit down for an interview. And Bonnie describes it as the greatest interview of my career, and the sound didn't work. So you can't say take two, right? It's over. It's gone. The moment is gone. And this is something that fascinates me about documentary, is creating narrative out of happenstance, out of accident. So how much can we do that? Well, I think that's a really interesting question, because I think the other thing that comes up from documentary is that it is, for many people, an educational tool. The number of times I have to tell my student that if they want to do their essay on this documentary or that documentary, these days it's always The Hunting Ground, then you have to do a documentary analysis of this documentary film. You can't just rewrite the arguments of The Hunting Ground back at me, because a documentary doesn't have the same obligations to accuracy and evidence that, you know, an academic paper has. And we've all watched documentaries where we've gone, yeah, I want to see your citation for that one, sort of thing, right? Including Not a Love Story. So when documentary is used as an educational tool as much as a artistic practice, there's a public discourse that happens. And in this film in particular, and in all of Studio D's films, they didn't just send it out. It didn't just show at the Carlton Cinemas. And in fact, it didn't show at the Carlton Cinemas. It would roll out across the country with the filmmakers and with educational packages and with local women's groups and educators coming in and using the film to have discussions. And so one of the interesting things that happened with this film in Montreal was that it did show in a commercial cinema. It ran for a very long time, and every night there was a discussion afterwards.
Facilitated or just...
Facilitated. Like, it would have at least two of Bonnie, Linda Lee, or Dorothy Haynoe, and sometimes Kathleen Shannon if they couldn't get enough of them, and then people from other networks and communities. So they were having these fabulous conversations in Montreal around sexuality and relationships and what do we want out of pleasure. And then they come down to Ontario and everybody's screaming censorship, and they're like, okay, we're opposed to censorship. But what they were isolated from was also a growing movement in queer sexuality, right? So what would have been by that point at most the LGB community were felt very threatened and frightened by this film, and rightly so, because we are still seeing to this day what I will call unholy alliances between feminists and moral conservatives against pornography, and this frightens me. I can give some of the anti-porn feminists a bit of a compassionate leave for some of their arguments, because they were just at this point of discovery. And one of the things I talk about in my book is that one of the things that feminists were discovering in the 1970s was the prevalence of sexual violence. It was unspoken, particularly family violence. Stories of child sexual abuse were coming out in consciousness-raising sessions, and then finding out that everyone there had had some experience of sexual violence resulted in the creation of rape crisis centers and women's health networks. Like, it wasn't all bad second wave feminism, and a horror to realize how pervasive it was. And that also just by accident coincides with what we call the golden age of porn. So I can kind of understand the cognitive dissonance of some of the anti-porn feminists going, porn, sexual violence, it's all getting jumbled up in their brain. I cannot forgive it in 2017. Sure. We know better.
But I do want to get at your struggle. I mean, when you're sitting down at the computer by yourself and you're writing... Yeah, it's a very powerful end of the book where they do have this incident with the photographer. I mean, let's be fair, Bonnie Cherklein comes off looking very good in this book. When you were sitting down at the computer thinking, okay, well, when this book goes out into the world, people might look at this documentary and say, oh, well, maybe there's more points than I thought. And I think some of the points are obviously are very good. The sex workers, their voices being heard. But I go back, I guess, again, the play is the thing. We have to acknowledge the completed film for what it is. And I wonder, and you're not the only one. There have been reparative articles about what Dworkin and MacKinnon said. Like, how do we dig out the good things that they said? And even there's a book out right now about how, this is way too dramatic, and maybe I'll edit it out. There's a book right now about Genghis Khan and what a good guy he was because he allowed religious freedom.
Oh,
right?
Dear God.
So, you know, I'm not in absolutely no way comparing Bonnie Cherklein to Genghis Khan. But I'm saying there are reparative histories that are meant to contextualize further what you do. But did you think about what the unintended consequences might be?
I think what I was trying to do was to actually go back and say, what if we started this conversation differently right from the onset? What if instead of 30, 40 years of these debilitating porn wars, what if we had begun the conversation with questions of labor and performance and self-determination? What if those had been the framing devices instead of censorship or violence? You know, what kind of politics could we have had? And what intrigued me about this film is that it wasn't just the film itself that took us down this road. It was the reception of the film that took us down this road. It was the anti-censorship debate that also glommed onto this film and started screaming it's pro-censorship. So the conversation that could have happened didn't happen. Personally, I'm no more a fan of censorship than anybody else, obviously, but I'm also not a fan of the censorship argument. And I talk about that in my other book, Pornography, Structures, Agency, and Performance, that once we start into the censorship model or the is it art model, then we're just, it's a heap of trouble. So rather than suggesting, well, it wasn't all bad, no, what I'm trying to say instead is we could have started the conversation differently, and we are all accountable for that. The academics are responsible for that, the critics and the supporters of the film. The audience is responsible for that. The Times were responsible for that. So that goes back to what I was saying about if Not a Love Story was made today, utterly unacceptable. But it was made before we had the language, and there's enough in that film to have had a different conversation. And instead, all of us, and that's where I come down to academic ethics, all of us are accountable to the fact that we had the wrong conversation for 30 years.
It's interesting that in both of your books, you mentioned the infamous 1982 academic conference where the forces of pro-pornography and anti-pornography feminists came to a head. I'd like to read a description about the event from your book, just in case people don't know. The disagreements between the anti-pornography movement and the anti-censorship movement and sex radical feminists became the basis of the, quote, sex wars in the 1980s. Tensions came to a head in 1982 and have never really ended. In April of 1982, the Women's Center at Barnard College, New York, held a conference in their series Scholar and the Feminist, entitled Towards a Politics of Sexuality, organized by Carol Vance, with Ellen Willis and Gail Rubin also on the organizing committee. The conference did not include anyone from the anti-pornography movement. Members of anti-pornography organizations were so outraged by what they called this rigged and dishonest approach that they contacted the administration of Barnard College and alerted them to the existence of a conference diary which included sexually explicit drawings by women. The administration responded by confiscating the diary. So it was interesting that you talked about the academic history of this split, which was something that isn't always emphasized in academia because it kind of makes them look bad. Can you talk a little bit more about the mood of this conference and expand a bit on the role you think academia had in creating this split, which is played out very much in Not a Love Story?
I think that pornography studies in academia has had a very problematic split of what I'll say a more pro-pornography position. I don't believe in pro-anti, but I'm just going to go with it for now. A more pro-pornography position occurring within a burgeoning field of queer studies, whereas women's studies kept lagging behind and continuing with an anti-porn line. Now, this has to do with just kind of basic histories of the labor market. The first generation of women academics come out of the 60s radical movements, and they are resolutely, for the most part, anti-porn, and they're the ones who get the first jobs, and then, you know, they're the ones who are hiring the second wave of jobs, and so on and so forth. And that split, especially in the 1990s, between gender and sexual politics, only understood as feminism versus queer, really undid the women's movement. And I'm of that generation. Okay, so I'm not of this generation of the Barnard Conference. I'm the aftermath where we kind of burned our own village to the ground. The women's movement went up in smoke around about the early 1990s. Studio D shut down by 96, but it was a shell of its former self by that point. Anyway, we usher in an era of post-feminism and a time of just losing rights that we had won and thinking that it's over. We took our foot off the gas, feminism is dead, and queer was a much more enticing and inviting space, even for a straight cis white woman like myself.
I mean, like the Judith Butler book, really.
Yeah.
Like the breaking point.
Yeah. And so feminism kind of lost some generational weight to pull it along forward. I would say that that has changed, that I'm actually quite proudly, you know, and staunchly a feminist scholar, and feel like there's a place to have the conversations that I couldn't have when I was a grad student. I was a feminist scholar as a grad student, but there were all kinds of conversations I didn't want to have, and chief among them was sexuality. In fact, my dissertation was on nuns, and when I was asked why I did not deal with the issue of sexuality in my dissertation, and I didn't at all, I was like, no, I don't want to. I do not want to go down that
road. And what year was that?
99. Mm. Like that late.
Wow.
Yeah, 99. I was like, I don't want to talk about it.
The idea of being a feminist scholar meant that sexuality had become way too toxic of a topic.
Exactly.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, I just didn't want to talk about it. And of course, my committee said, well, you kind of gotta. So when I eventually turned it into a book, I did, and happily so. And that's actually what got me moving forward. The book on nuns called Visual Habits comes out, I think, in like 2005. So there's already enough kind of like interesting little inklings going on where I'm like, there might be a better conversation about sexuality to be had in the 21st century. And what drew me to pornography studies was much braver and bolder and questioning academics than I. Starting to do some work about thinking about maybe pornography's not so bad. And I didn't really have any opinion on pornography other than I was kind of interested in the polarized debates about it. But starting to find out that there were some people trying to do feminist pornography differently. And I will say kind of in the early 2000s, it was still kind of awful in my opinion. But it started to get better. And so it wasn't the academics who built this. It was the activists. It was the performers. It are the people who literally put their bodies on the line, their bodies at risk, to produce something that we desperately needed, and we didn't even know what it was or what it would look like or how it would be performed. And they kept using their bodies to find it and to build it. And then I was just so in awe of the strength and intellectual fortitude of these performers who were thinking through their sexual performance, and the fact that many of them were informed by their undergraduate work in queer theory that had given them the ability to figure out where would feminism fit in this. So a shout out to all of them. I don't want to start naming because I'll forget, but academics, oh, the current state of porn studies, not to other academics, in my opinion. We owe it to the performers. And that's why I take the sex work ethics so seriously. It's because they built that language. The language that was missing at the time of Not a Love Story, the conversation that I wish we could have had, it wasn't film scholars who figured out how to have it. It wasn't feminist scholars who figured out how to have it. It was porn performers who figured out how to have it.
So your advice to academics would be go back to the street.
Go back to the street. This is where we find the good stuff. Exactly.
Well, thank you very much, Rebecca. We're finally going to get to leave Toronto. Fake teardrop.
Yeah,
but no, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Once again, I want to thank Rebecca for taking all of the technical issues in stride and giving a great interview. Please do check out her book after you've watched Not a Love Story. I don't think you'll regret watching or reading either one. They really do cover an important time in porn's history and in the feminist movement. After all that, please do follow our podcast on social media. You can find us on facebook.com/academicsex and on Twitter @pornocultures. Thanks so much for listening, and I look forward to getting sexy with you next time. Bye.